This call is now being recorded.
Thank you very much, Tim. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. This is the IRCPD Working Group call on the 13th of May 2013. On the call today, we have Volker Greiman, Rob Golding, Bartlett Morgan, Mikey O'Connor, Graham Bunton, Chris Chaplow, Barbara Knight, Angie Graves, Jill Titzer, Oliver Hope, James Liddell, and Simonetta Batiger. We have apologies from Holly Reich, Alan Greenberg, Bob Mountain, and Paul Diaz. From staff, we have Lars Hoffman, Marika Koenig will join us shortly, and myself, Natalie Pogan. I'd like to remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you, Natalie, and welcome everyone to the IRTPD Policy Working Group call for, I believe it's May 13th. And per our standard procedures, please raise your hand or interrupt me if you are not in the Adobe room if you have any updates to your statement of interest. Seeing none, we'll move on to comments or questions or suggestions regarding our proposed agenda, which is displayed in the right-hand column of the Adobe room and was circulated to the email address earlier by Lars. Okay, so let's consider that agenda adopted, and we'll dive right in. Of course, last week we had so many apologies, I think, due to a conflict with a community webinar that we had to postpone the meeting, so we lost the day there, but in the interim, I think we got some, received some useful information and data regarding disputes and TVRP statistics. So I'm trying to think of where the best way to approach that is, but kind of jumping ahead a little bit in our agenda, but when we get to that point, I think, Mikey, perhaps when we get to item number three, we can turn that over to you, and then we can also ask Lars maybe to gather the three or four responses. I know, Lars, you said something about putting together a master document of the statistics or combining or aggregating those statistics. Is that, did I understand you correctly?
Yes, this is Lars. And yeah, we were thinking with Marika to aggregate all the information we received, starting with the compliance reports and then gathering some anecdotal evidence from the various registrars. And then the hard data from VeriSign and DNFF and the agent provider as well, so that we have an overview document to see exactly, maybe even be able to link the various cases, if we can, that have moved from the first to the second level disputes, with something that might be able to join also later or feed into the initial report. So I'm working on something like that, which will hopefully be ready for next week's meeting.
Okay, thank you, Lars. And so that's a final call, I guess, to any registries or registrars participating in the working group that want to submit some data in, on this topic that have not already done so. Please get that to the mailing list as soon as possible so that it can be included in that aggregated report. So then, continuing on with our review, I think we last left our heroes. We were looking at the community input review tool. I don't know if staff has that handy or can upload that to the Adobe room while we're teeing it up here. But I think we got through a couple of responses in our discussion specific to our charter questions. And I'm trying to see where it was we left off. Did we get through comment number two, Lars?
Well, I'm struggling with the move button. This is Lars. Yes, I think we moved on. We got through two, and we should restart with three.
Okay, thank you. So looking now at comment number three, first of all, did anyone have any, I know it's been a couple of weeks here, but I certainly didn't want to close the door on comment number one and number two, which were the only comments received on charter question A. So if anyone has any last parting thoughts or closing statements on those, we certainly can accept them at this time. Otherwise, I suggest we can move on to comment number three. And, of course, nothing's final in ICANN. We can always go back, circle back if something new comes up. But I don't see any hands, so let's just move on to comment number three. I'll read this out. Additional provisions should be included multiple transfers in the transfer dispute resolution policy, TDRP, that set out how to handle disputes when multiple transfers have occurred, as they could help clarify the process and facilitate the handling of disputes. Multiple transfers are used in domain name hijack situations, and also since the aftermarket has developed since the policy was written, a third party can easily purchase a hijack domain in good faith. This comment is coming from the business constituency. And I think just for clarity, what we're discussing here is the situation. I think some have called it registrar hopping, some have called it domain name laundering. That's the process by which a domain name is hijacked or stolen and then transferred through multiple registrars in a very short period of time so as to confuse the origin and history of a domain name, and so that the ultimate final purchaser is unaware that the domain name, for lack of a better term, is stolen property. I know we don't like to use the word property with domain names, but they're not aware of the circumstances under which the seller acquired the domain name, and also to thwart any attempts to recover the domain name for the original registrant, because, of course, the gaining and losing registrars are now part of a chain of events as opposed to just two parties. So I think that what we're seeing here from the business constituency is that they accurately captured or described the problem in their comment. I don't see them necessarily offering any specific policy recommendations except to note that it is a problem and that there should be provisions developed to address this. So one thing I would point out is that for those who are maybe less familiar with the transfer policy is that there is a provision that allows a registrar to reject a transfer request if it's within 60 days of a previous transfer request. However, as we've discussed in previous working groups, that is optional. That's not a mandatory requirement. And I think we want to, well, we don't want to go back and revisit some of those arguments as well necessarily, but wanted to point out that that is something that was examined in a previous IRTP working group. I think it was maybe B or C, and that ultimately that that working group did not recommend that that optional requirement become mandatory. So so with that, I'll take a cue if anyone has any comments or anything to offer on this particular comment. Item number three. Quiet group today. Maybe we should have passed out coffee, Mikey. Chris Chaplow, you're up first.
Hello there, can you hear me?
Yes,
yep.
Can.
Yeah, good. Yeah, it's just a really a comment. When we say additional provisions, that, if it isn't necessarily in the form of mechanical process, it might be in the form of education and guidance. And you're right in noting that PC are stating a problem and not really offering a solution because, frankly, I, for one, wouldn't not quite sure where to turn if a domain had gone through all these multiple transfers. So it's that's where the feeling for this comes from. You know, you've got different people saying, well, I bought it in good faith and so on, and recognising that the aftermarket exists now and it wasn't when the rules were created. So maybe the registrars who have got experience of this sort of problem, and hopefully it isn't too frequent, but there are times when, you know, how they begin to sort this one out. Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Chris. I can tell you that a lot of the major registrars have adopted the optional. Will not accept transfers on the transfer request on a name that is 60 days from a previous transfer. That's not a requirement, of course, and the hijackers, unfortunately, are very smart and crafty people who know exactly which registrars are not following that process. And, of course, we'll use them as part of this chain of hops to include in multiple transfers. I think it does present a problem, and I don't necessarily fault the BC in their comment for not really offering a specific or a concrete solution, because, and I'm just putting on my registrar hat here, it does represent a bit of a boundary problem, because if you say, well, you know, you have to allow folks to go back in time X number of days or Y number of transfers to resolve a TDRP, well, then, you know, what about those cases where there is a domain name that is legitimate and has been mobily and correctly changed hands multiple times? Then, you know, I think the term for this, the aftermarket term for this, is clawback, you know, where someone three or four transactions ago now wants to exercise rights against the current registrant. So it does become kind of a sticky problem to solve. Rob Golding, you're up next.
You already have the rule that says you can't transfer a domain that's 30 days or less from a previous transfer, and we have in our policies actually to extend that to 60 days, which we make our registrants aware of when they bring one in the first place. They can't take it away again for 2 months. Is even more provisions beyond the current 30-day requirement that's put there by ICANN and a registrar being able to extend that through their terms and conditions really actually necessary?
Well, thanks, Rob. And as we were discussing, it unfortunately is an option that is available to registrars to reject a transfer, but there are some registrars who opt not to enforce that, and those are the registrars that are used in this process. Mikey.
Hi, James. It's Mikey. Another thing that sort of folds into this is this piece that came out of the last IRTP, which is the new distinction between change of registrant and change of registrar, which may bear on this. You know, when this rule was written, there was no acknowledgement of that change of registrant idea. And I don't know how that bears on this one, but I thought I'd throw that into the conversational mix.
Okay, that's a good point, and maybe that's possibly what maybe what Rob was alluding to as well, because I don't remember if in the recommendations for IRTPC if we included a moratorium on when the change of registrant occurs, that there is a lock for change of registrar. I'll have to go back and revisit that, but that's a good point, Mikey. And for those that are just joining us and weren't not participating in IRTPC, it's worth pointing out that we did make a distinction between change of registrar and change of registrant as two different types or flavors of transfers. And it's worth noting that those policy changes have not yet been implemented by ICANN. They have only been approved. So we're still operating kind of in a little bit of a gray area where we've approved these policy changes, but they haven't been adopted yet. Volker, you're up next.
Yeah, I think the comment there also mentions one point which makes me very careful in adding additional provisions for such cases, and that is the mention of the good faith purchaser, who also should be protected in a way, because he may have made substantial investments in the domain name if he bought it on an auction platform or paid top dollar for a good domain name, which may have been hijacked 4 years ago and then ripened by the hijacker, or have been transferred a lot of times between different registrants and different portfolios, and simply we do not know at which point the hijack stops and at which point the legitimate ownership of the next owner starts. And as a registrar, I don't want to make that decision at any point.
Thank you, Volker, and I agree. Registrars are very reluctant to insert themselves into a position of adjudicating those kinds of disputes. Mikey, you're up next.
Yeah, this is Mikey. I'm just responding to Volker. I think that's part of the reason and role for this process. I think the TDRP isn't for the normal course of events. I think it's for the complicated ones. And Volker, I think you're describing one of the complicated use cases. And so, you know, I think it's okay to leave that use case in scope for this discussion, because I think this discussion is not for the routine stuff.
Sorry, I was speaking to the mute button. Thank you, Mikey. So I see that the queue is clear. Graham, you posted something in the chat. I don't know if you wanted to raise that, or can you elaborate on your question or comment? I hate to put you on the spot, but...
Sorry, this is Graham Bunton speaking. It's just that if we, you know, those scenarios happen, if we, you know, move on without addressing where domains have been moved more than once, are we, you know, leaving ourselves open for another round of looking at transfer process and dispute resolution, because there's a whole bunch of people dissatisfied with what we've done.
Thanks, Graham. I agree. It sounds like I certainly don't want to leave this incomplete. And it certainly seems like the status quo, while it's not necessarily common, the harms are fairly significant when it does occur. Simonetta?
I'm wondering what would actually have to change and what people mean with additional provisions, because if it's as simple as, let's say, the current policy says you have to contact the losing registrar or the gaining registrar, and it could be by something like you may contact any registrar who had been in the chain in the last, I don't know, 6 months or something like that, where you say that contact anybody if you need help, and that might already solve some of the things that would need to be addressed if multiple people are included, and or include something that says, I think one of the issues really is that if the thing jumps, then you can just keep transferring and nothing locks the domain down until the transfer, the dispute has been resolved. And if there would be just something like, if one of the registrars in the chain who had possession of this name in the last 6 months is notified of this case and has reason to believe that this is not just a joke, then they can notify the registry to prohibit that the name keeps jumping until the situation has been resolved. If it's as simple as that, then maybe that gets at the core of the issue here.
Okay, thank you, Simonetta. And if I'm understanding you correctly, you're saying that if we are under the impression that something like this has occurred, where there have been multiple transfers in a short period of time, I think multiple and short probably need some specific definition, but in general, that the registrar, any registrar that was part of that chain of events could be contacted to initiate this TDRP, but the registry, since it would have visibility to the entire sequence of transfers, whereas the registrar might only say, yep, it came to me legitimately and it left me legitimately, and anything that happened before or since is kind of out of my hands. And I think that's where we're kind of looking to the registry to provide that perspective of the entire chain of events. Am I capturing your statement correctly? Or
yes, but I'm also wondering what it is that people meant when they said additional provisions, because maybe it is just a little wording thing that needs change, and it would address both a situation where only two registrars are involved, as well as a situation where multiple registrars are involved if the domain name has jumped multiple times. And I guess you are right. We should define what is multiple times and its time frame, because obviously a very old name could have changed hands three times over the course of 6 years, and that's not what we mean here. We mean something where a name goes between three or four registrars in a relatively short amount of time.
Correct. So maybe one of these additional provisions could be to, I'm noting that there is a PDP that's just concluding on UDRP locking practices, so that when a UDRP is filed against a domain name, they wanted some uniform practices to lock those names against transfer. So perhaps the TDRP needs to mirror those practices, so that when a TDRP is filed against a domain name, it certainly doesn't go any further, and then we can set some rules against but something that makes sense for, let's say, three or more transfers in a 30-day period or something like that, that doesn't cast such a wide net that it catches legitimate transactions, but only zeroes in on those incidences that are this actual practice of hopping. Of course, whatever we publish, the bad guys are just going to read that and then add one day to it, and then proceed accordingly. So we have to keep that in mind as well.
I think what the if you make this a reasonable amount of time, the issue with the multiple hops is that it happens so quickly that you have no time to react. So if you force someone that they wait for 30 or 60 days until they would go around a rule like this, and the rule only really says that you may contact anyone who was in chain, and that contact should result in the domain name being locked until the dispute has been resolved, which may then take much longer, then you don't really have that problem anymore.
Okay, thank you, Simonetta. And hopefully we've got our folks who are capturing this stuff for our response, but I think that's a good point. So the queue is now clear. Let's move.
Taking notes.
Oh, you are? Okay. Thanks, Mikey. I wasn't sure if... Okay, so let's move on to number four on the same topic, but now submitted from the registry stakeholder group. And again, this was part of their response to the preliminary issues report. So under the TDRP, a dispute must be filed within 6 months of the violation. Consistent application of the 60-day restriction on inter-registrar transfers after a transfer should help to reduce the instances of multiple transfers. Registry stakeholder group would support consideration of a modification to the TDRP to clarify the impact of a fraudulent transfer on subsequent transfers. So looking at the first sentence, I think there's where we're saying that there's a six-month, I'm going to butcher this here, term of art, but let's say it's a six-month statute of limitations. So if you're disputing a transfer that occurred more than 6 months ago, I think the TDRP is not for you. Consistent application of the 60-day restriction would help. I agree with that statement. However, as we mentioned in the outset, that was something that we looked at making mandatory in a previous working group, and that was not supported. So perhaps the right course of action here is a strong recommendation for best practice and further education, not just of registrants, but also registrars, that they should want to support this wherever possible. Aftermarket registrars may have a different view on this, but hopefully they would also have different practices involving transfers to prevent this problem. And then the final sentence here, the registry stakeholder group would support consideration of modification of TDRP to clarify the impact of fraudulent transfers on subsequent transfers. And I think what I'm understanding here is similar to what Simonetta was saying, which is that TDRP should lock a domain name against further transfers until the dispute is resolved. But otherwise, I'm seeing here the consideration of a modification to clarify. I'm wondering if we have any of our registry reps on the call today that would like to weigh in on helping us understand the meaning here. Barbara, thank you for rescuing me.
No worries, James. This is Barbara. So I think the intent here was, to the extent that they wanted that we could come up with some sort of, I guess, process or just, you know, when we're referring to clarification here, I think we were referring to the fact that it really say how, you know, registry operators or the second level dispute providers really should handle cases where there are multiple POPs. And so I think that if there's, a way to, and some of the suggestions I think that were put forward were actually kind of, good ideas, where you do, more proactively engage the registrars that were involved throughout the course of the transfer dispute, if you will. Obviously what's being disputed is going to be the one that started the process, which was, the transfer that was alleged in violation of the policy. But, if it's, three registrars, down the road now, to, more actively involve at least, at a minimum, the last registrar, the current registrar that currently has the name, to, see what their take is on it and, come up with, some, standard processes or procedures for how to deal with that in instances where it does happen. So it's kind of the thoughts that we had in mind.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. I put myself in the queue to offer an idea here, and I wanted to take off the chair hat and put on a registrar hat if I could for a minute. And of course, Mikey, I'm looking to you to keep me in line and smack me if I ever forget to qualify that statement. But one thought might be that the TDRP would be in the event that we detected that this practice was occurring. And again, it's back to Simonetta's point that a certain number of transfers within a certain time frame, that all registrars would be required to participate and provide documentation, not just the initial registrar that reported the fraudulent transfer or the registrar where the domain name landed when the transfer, the hijack was detected, but all the registrars in the chain would now be on the hook for providing documentation, FOAs and log files and everything else that they believe would have been relevant so that the TDRP provider can piece together the sequence of events. I think that might help in ensuring that there are no gaps in the understanding of how the transfer occurred, but also it might encourage registrars who are currently allowing transfers within short periods of time of previous transfers. Maybe they would rethink that practice and adopt this best practice of of taking a little bit more care in that regard. So, Barbara, your hand is up. I'll turn it over to you. I'm hoping that you're going to tell me that that's already required.
Thanks, James. From our perspective, we do not require that today. The concern that I would have with that is the same concern that I have with just, transfer disputes overall is, making certain that anybody who may have information relative to that transfer is actually providing it. I know from our perspective, a lot of times a transfer dispute will be filed, and of course the non-filing registrar has 7 days to respond to that and provide their side of the story. Many times there is absolutely no response received from the other registrar in the case, and looking at that information that came in from Christine, it looked like, in some cases, they also don't get any response from the other party to the case. So I think it's an excellent idea how you get people to participate and provide the data, I think, is going to be the biggest challenge.
All right, mute button. Yeah, that's an excellent point, how to compel them to respond when they really don't have anything on the line anymore, if the domain name has already entered and left their management. But maybe something to consider, and I noticed that Simonetta in the chat posted a statement that she likes the suggestion to make registrars in the chain obligated to cooperate. Simonetta, your hand is up. Do you want to elaborate?
I'm wondering if sometimes maybe you don't respond because you don't have information, but I think it would still be okay to ask that registrar to at least say, yes, I've received your request. I'm really sorry, I don't have anything I can tell you, which is a response and might be all they can do, or they tell you, okay, I've informed whoever they need to inform about something and set them a deadline and just give a status, because maybe that is also all it takes at that point, because if that registrar truly deals with the fraudulent party, they will likely not get a response from them, or they'll only have fake information.
Thanks, that's a good point. Even responding with "I have no information" would be a response in this case, but hopefully they at least have an incoming and an outgoing FOA as per the policy. I think that would be the minimum response we would expect. I think Barbara was first, but I will always defer to co-chair Mikey.
No, let Barbara go.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. Barbara, you're up.
Thank you, Mikey and James. This is Barbara. So I think that, you know, James, you're right. I mean, that was what I was going to say is, you know, at a minimum, there should be FOAs involved, and there should also be, you know, some logs that show, you know, the who is data as far as who the registrant was at the time the transfers occurred. There should be, you know, some data that could be provided to at least, I guess, give some idea that important transfers were, I guess, were legitimate, if you will. So, you know, I think that no information is really not an option here, because under the policy, you know, all registrars are to maintain, at minimum, at least the FOAs.
Good point. Okay, thanks, Barbara. Mikey.
This is Mikey. The other thing, this is another throw-in, another one of our policies. I haven't really thought this through, but maybe the TIAC process that we came up with in IRTPB, I think, could be a model for this as well, where we sort of place an obligation on registrars to at least respond. And I do like the idea of at least respond with what should be available data, FOA, who is records, stuff like that, logs, whatever. So anyway, it's just another, mostly I want to get it on the record so I can type it into the notes, because it seems like that might be a model that we could take a look at.
Okay, thanks, Mikey. I think if I'm understanding you correctly, we could mirror any sort of requirement that compels a registrar to respond after the TIAC, which has a, I believe, which has a four-hour window for a required response. Maybe that might be a little too tight to gather up all the information required in this case, but I think it's something to jump off. It's a jumping-off point for any sort of requirement here, because it does say that, you know, not really concerned about the content of your response, but silence is not an option. Okay. Well, I think we've got the queue is clear. We're down to the last. This is the last comment, the second and last comment on charter question B. I think the general tone or the sentiment, and of course counting on Mikey's notes and the staff's as well, but the general sentiment is that this is an issue, and that the TDRP perhaps could be improved to close some of the gaps that allow, or loopholes that allow this to occur. We could do so by compelling all registrars in the chain to participate in the investigation by providing at a minimum, the documentation that they're required to collect during the transfer process. At least two FOAs, and any other information that they have in excess of that, like log files or any other who is or customer contact information, that we would probably need to define how many transfers is too many and how short of a time period is too short. I think those are some fuzzy logic problems that we'll probably have to discuss further. And then, of course, we could also make a recommendation that the practice of not allowing transfers within 60 days is not required, but it is one best practice that could address this, although it might not fit all business models. And that the TIAC mechanism could be used to you know, as a guide, as well as the UDRP locking PDP, could be used as a model for anything that comes out of this group. So did that capture? I'm doing that sort of from memory and notes here. Hopefully that captures what we were where we were landing with this group.
Oh, this is Mikey. I'm just going to barge in. Yeah, that's pretty close to what I've got in my notes as well.
Okay, excellent. Thanks, Mike. Okay, so then if there are no other comments, we can move on to the comments received for charter question C. Should dispute options for registrants be developed and implemented as part of the IRTP? And I think that the gist of this is essentially that registrars initiate the TDRP typically on behalf of their customer, the registrant, but they're not required or obligated to do so. So I see Rob has his hand raised before we dive into the two comments received, and then Rob's hand went down. Okay. So, I'm sorry, Mikey, there was one other thing that we missed in the previous one, which was that we discussed the interplay between of the new IRTPC change of registrant policy and how that might affect this issue. So I didn't capture that. I just remembered it, and we might want to make sure that's part of our notes as well. I'm sure you probably caught it, but I missed it. So, Rob, go ahead.
Before we move off of the TDRP kind of comments, VeriSign sent out an email to list about TDRPs, and one of the lines in there sort of struck a chord with me, which is that the administrative contact authorized the transfer without the knowledge of the registered name holder, 8 cases. Now, that was something I know we touched on in IRTPB, is who really should be authorizing transfers and who should we be accepting FOA from and who really has ultimate say over the domain. Our own policy has always been that the registrant is the final authority on things because it's their domain name. That's partly clouded by our own opinions, and that's also because historically we've been involved with .uk a lot more than .com and .net, and that's the policy within .uk, in fact, to the point now where they don't really have administrative contacts or technical contacts on .uk's anymore. There's just the registrant. So we would always take the registrant's wishes as the final decision on whether or not to move the domain. But it's quite clear from the stuff VeriSign sent out that there are cases where the admin contact moves them and the registered name holder doesn't know anything about it. We see this regularly with designers moving around to whoever's cheapest this week. And then when the customer actually rings us up and says, I'd like to change the name servers on my domain, and we go, you moved it 6 months ago. And they go, no, we didn't. And we go, yeah, you did. It's an issue. So should we, if we're also discussing the TDRP as part of IRTP, also be trying to set actual rules or best practices on who should be authorizing domain transfers?
Thanks, Rob. And I hate to complicate things or make things even messier or cloud the waters, but the situation you described was exactly part of our charter for one of the other IRTPs, one of the very early ones, and I'm stretching my memory here if it was IRTPA or IRTPB, but now we're going back to 2010, 2011, the charter question was twofold, which was what to do in those situations where the transfer was authorized by the administrative contact but later was opposed by the registered name holder. I think one of the challenges we discovered was that in particularly in FIN registries, but I think it applies to others as well, is that the registered name holder's email address was not always available to registrars to initiate a transfer. So that the administrative contact was used in that regard. And I think that was perhaps more, as I said, more of an issue for thin registries than thick registries. And so the two questions that we discussed were how to resolve those situations where the registered name holder and the administrative contact don't agree, and how registrars would have access to the email address of the registered name holder. I'm going to have to punt now to staff to maybe help us dig up the conclusions that we came to in examining those questions, because I think they're relevant to the question that Rob is posing here about those, and then I think that they do perhaps have bearing on charter question B. Mikey, can you clarify or crystallize our memory on this one?
Two things. This is Mikey. Yes, we certainly did spend a lot of time on this and did not arrive at a consensus as to what to do. And a lot of that was because of the challenges posed by a thin registry. And so one of the things that I wanted to throw into the conversation is that we do have a thick whois PDP that's going on right now that I'm reluctant to characterize how it's going to turn out until it turns out. But if we eliminated the thin whois model, that might bear on this topic. And I'm not exactly sure how we reopen a topic that's been addressed in a prior PDP, but we might want to put that on a list of things that we want to revisit towards the end of this PDP. Because the timing of the thick whois PDP is that the initial report, at least, is going to be done by Durbin, so we'll have an answer, a preliminary answer anyway, within 6 or 8 weeks. And that might bear on the conclusion we came to back, I think it was IRTPB, but I'll leave that to Marika. She's smarter about stuff like that than me.
Hey, thanks, Mikey. And, you know, I have some thoughts on this, but I'll just go to Marika first, and then I'll put myself in the queue. Marika, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Marika. I think what we did do under IRTPB Part B, and I think that is currently enforced, there is a requirement to send the a copy of the FOA to the losing registrar or to the registrant as an additional mechanism to make sure that if there is a case where the admin conduct has requested a transfer and the registrant is actually not aware of it, that that can serve as a trigger point. So I think that is one of the measures that came out of that working group. But I think, yeah, we also, one of those recommendations additionally coming out of that working group was indeed this consideration that thick whois would actually solve a lot of those issues, and a suggestion that a PDP would be initiated on that topic, which is currently underway but hasn't completed yet or concluded yet. So I think that's at least my recollection of the discussion.
Okay, thank you, Marika. And I see Mikey has his hand up. Mikey, before I let you go, can you clarify, I think, aren't you the chair or co-chair of that thick whois?
I am indeed the chair of that one. And just
so you can help be an effective liaison.
Yeah, I can certainly do that. I think the key is that thick whois is a link in this chain. Once that link of the chain has been completed, then I think IRTP needs to be looked at, given that the changes have been made. So we've got sort of this chicken and egg problem that we may have to go back to council or somebody to either slightly change the charter of this PDP to be able to revisit that, or much as I dread to say it, we might need one more instance of IRTP in order to resolve this one.
So thanks, Mikey, and I'll put my comment on that last statement in the chat box. So this is James just speaking now on my personal, just as a personal participant of the working group. I think that we got a couple of issues here. Going back to our predecessors and ancestors, some of whom may be on this call and some of whom maybe are in other areas of ICANN or have graduated to councils and boards or maybe have left the industry entirely, but when they originally set up this series of working groups, I think they may have anticipated or perhaps it had not occurred to factored into their decisions, but one of the issues that could have come up was this idea that the interdependency between some of these issues, the charter questions, that topics would come up later on after they had already been either discussed or resolved. I think in order to enforce the greater good, which is that this group be the last, be the caboose in that IRTP chain of PDPs, we might want to grant ourselves a little bit of latitude in revisiting issues that might have been discussed and I'm using air quotes over here, closed in previous sessions. What I mean is that if in the discussion of our charter question B or C, we determine that we really need to put a charter question from IRTP A back under a microscope, I think we should, you know, without overturning things that we've already done, we should at least allow ourselves the ability to discuss those things, just because it's more of a recognition of the interdependencies of these working groups. And just as we've identified an interdependency with the SICK Who Is working group. So I just wanted to put that out on the table. We shouldn't necessarily close the door to those discussions if we feel it can help. We certainly don't want to allow second and third and fourth bites at an apple. But if we think it can help help us achieve our goal, we should do so, just so that we don't spill over into any other future iterations of this series. And then to address Mikey's other question, I think that the challenge then becomes if we treat this as a discrete problem, the challenge is that we solve, in this working group, we solve for the SICK registry problem and then let the SICK Who Is working group proceed on its own course. And without presuming the outcome, we assume that if thin registries become thick, then they will inherit whatever solutions we come up here. So I'll stop there and I'll turn it over to Mike. Go ahead, Mike.
Not much to disagree with there. I just wanted to slightly hone that. I like your notion that we are the last and thus have some sort of extraordinary rights to look back into the prior set of IRTP PDPs. I think we might want to run that idea past the council in some way. And Volker, I think you're our council liaison. So it might be that Marika, Volker, Mikey, James want to huddle and figure out the right way to communicate that back to the council so that we at least let them know and let them object. But, you know, I wholeheartedly agree with your yikes comment in the chat. I really don't want to have another one of these. It's just that looking back over all the prior decisions, opening that up is a bit of a change to the scope of what we're doing, and we might want to refine that and write that up and let the council know.
I agree, Mikey, and maybe this is something that we can visit with Volker, and perhaps the bar should be very, very high. You know, for example, if IRTPD wants to revisit an issue that was part of a charter question in IRTPA, that, you know, it must be a unanimous decision or something like that. You can't just go based on, you know, well, a couple people spoke out about this on this one call, and so we're going to reopen, you know, TAC or something like, you know, I'm being dramatic here for effect, but I think that you're right. We want to put that under scrutiny if part of the the function of this working group is going to be to take a look at the whole series. But I think that I think council would also agree that you know, the sentiment that we don't want there to be an IRTPE, that we don't want things to spill over, that this should be the last link in the chain, and in order to do that, we probably need some latitude in that area, but the bar should be fairly high. So, Volker, did you? Yes. Yes, I see your chat. Yes, we would write something up and take that back to council, and I think we'd probably just miss a document cutoff, did we not, Volker? So we're probably shooting for the June council meeting.
We can still discuss it even if we're not meeting. We also have the possibility to discuss it on the call after the next meeting. So I think we should be able to discuss it on the list, and then I can get a feel of the room, the temperature of the room in the in the council, even if we don't have a decision on that yet.
So, okay, thanks.
Along with that.
Thanks, Volker. And if you can keep your toe in the door, keep that wedged open just a little bit longer, we will endeavor to get something to you quickly.
Sure thing.
Okay, thanks, everyone. And it's a good point, and probably something that we didn't consider as part of our you know, kind of a meta question we didn't really discuss, but excellent discussion. I see we have 5 minutes left, and I wanted to tee up the next question here, charter question C, where we have two comments as well. But this is really about who has the ability to initiate a TDRP. Currently, that is a registrar function. Certainly they're not doing this on their own accord. They're doing this in response to a request from a registrant, registered name holder. But what about those situations where a registered name holder believes that they want to initiate a TDRP and the registrar is not cooperating? So I think we certainly need to examine that question when we resume. So, but we have a few minutes left. I turn it over to Mikey to see if he has anything he wants to add or discuss in closing here today.
Nope, I agree. This is good. I think we're making great strides, and it seems like we're headed to some really interesting and useful solutions.
I think so too, Mikey, although silver bullets are few and far between in ICANN world, especially about transfers. I think it's always good to make progress and to feel when you're making to feel like you've got an hour well spent, and I think that's definitely the case today. So next week we will continue here at the bottom of page 3 with charter question C. Please contribute to the list. We'll look for a aggregated TDRP data set from staff, as well as a response or at least an update on our posing of the issue we just discussed over to council from Volker, and we will go from there. So anyone, again, if you are a registry or a registrar and you want to submit some TDRP statistics and you have not already done so, please get those to the list as soon as possible. Otherwise, if there are no further comments, we'll close the call for today and say thanks, everyone, and see you next week.
Thanks, James.
Thank you, James.
Bye now.
Thank you.
Thanks, James.
Thank you.